The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
At the time, the only people who became vice presidents were people who were at the tail end of their career and kind of looked the part or were from a particular state or people who needed to be punished. In Teddy Roosevelt's case, the party bosses wanted to exile him to the political equivalent of Elba, and the vice presidency was the perfect place to do that. And Teddy Roosevelt himself, as young as he was conscious of the fact that this could be his political end. And you're right that Mark Hanna, who was a close confidant of William McKinley, was terrified of this, and you know, he's the first one to really talk about a heartbeat away from the president. He tells McKinley, after Teddy Roosevelt gets the nomination as vice president, that your job, Mr. President, is to live for the next 4 years. And of course, McKinley is shot in September of 1901, not long after the election. And Teddy Roosevelt, who his entire life has dreamed of being president, can sort of hardly contain his enthusiasm for the fact that he's about to become president, right? So he asserts himself very quickly, and he has the most amazing quote of any of the accidental presidents, which is, it's a terrible thing to come into the presidency this way, but it would be far worse to be morbid about it.
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare podcast for May 14th, 2019. Jared Cohen is the founder and CEO of Jigsaw at Alphabet Inc., who previously ran Google Ideas and served as a member of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and as an advisor to Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton. He is also the author of a new book on the presidency called Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America. It describes the times in American history that a president has died in office, forcing 8 other men who were neither the voters nor their party's choice to confront unparalleled challenges. I chatted with him recently about their stories and the lessons we can learn from their experiences. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 417, Jared Cohen on Accidental Presidents. Welcome to the Lawfare Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Your book, Accidental Presidents, it's a full survey of the 8 men who have come to office due to the deaths of their predecessors. And I noticed you began researching and writing this book not recently. You're going back a few years, back to when President Obama was still the president and Donald Trump wasn't even a leading candidate for the election in 2016. Why this topic at that time?
So if I look at my own career, it's a portfolio of my curiosities. And I've always had this lingering curiosity about presidential transition that goes back to when I was 8 years old and my parents bought me a children's book, one of those rhyming books about the presidents, one page per president. And my poor parents, aiming to turn me into a precocious child, didn't realize they were going to have 8 conversations with me about death and 4 conversations about assassination. So my poor parents didn't even know who William McKinley was, let alone having to explain to me why his head was keeled over. And it was just this obsession that stayed with me my whole life. And, you know, I woke up one day and I said, I finally have to write a book about this. I'm tired of looking at all of these stories in different places. I want to put them all together and tell the story of how we basically winged presidential succession.
And this all started with a rhyming book. What was the rhyme for William McKinley?
I don't remember the specific rhyme for William McKinley. I remember the one for Andrew Johnson, which was 10 and 7, Johnson A, they almost took his job away.
And they almost did. We'll be getting to that as we talk through this. You're covering you cover almost all of American political history because you tell the stories, of course, of the 8 men who became president. But to do so, you tell the stories of the 8 men who lost their lives during their presidency and then the connective tissue between them. That meant you had to do a lot of research and you had to use a lot of sources. Obviously, there are more sources available on JFK than on Millard Fillmore or John Tyler, but you did dig back and find what you could. How did you attack the research for this project?
That's a great question, and it was really one of the great joys of the project was going chapter by chapter and digging into this. And what's nice is I'd spent my entire life reading biographies on the eight men who died and biographies on the eight men who ascended. So I had a nice foundational knowledge, but I also had a wonderful collection of secondary resources. And like anything, you start with the secondary resources and you figure out what's been told already, what hasn't been told, where are the gaps. And then I wanted to tell this story in a way that I would have wanted to hear it. So a lot of my archival research focuses on the particular aspects of this story that I found most interesting. Like I got really interested in the fact that six of the eight accidental presidents themselves nearly died in office, and there was no provision for replacing the Vice President of the United States until the 25th Amendment was passed in 1967. So I chose to tell those close call stories. You know, I spent time at the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress has also put every periodical since 1840 online, which is a brilliant way to capture firsthand accounts of particular incidents. But my favorite part for your audience, my wife is a lawyer, my sister is a lawyer, my brother-in-law is a lawyer, and they're all fascinated by the fact that I pulled from dozens of law review articles going back 100 plus years for this book.
Yeah, and it really comes out in the telling of each story that you've pulled from the best, if you will, the best histories that were written about the presidents and their times, but also done some dives into some of that primary source material. You even did some interviews, and it's interesting, your interviews with people like George H.W. Bush, Henry Kissinger, Condi Rice. They weren't interviews about their presidencies or about their experiences. In fact, I think they commented more on people like Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson than others. How did you use the interviews to supplement your research?
That's right. And it was a really special experience doing these interviews because these are all people that I've known or had known for some time. And I'd never, for instance, I worked for Condi Rice. I'd never had a conversation with her about civil rights before and what it was like growing up in Alabama at the height of segregation. I worked in the Bush administration, and I'd never talked to Vice President Cheney about, you know, what it was like in the Ford administration. So in some cases, I think in the case of Vice President Cheney, he was thrilled to not be doing an interview about Iraq and Afghanistan and enjoyed recalling the stories of Lynette Squeaky Fromm and Sarah Jane Moore taking shots at Gerald Ford.
Let's go back to the first accidental president, as you call him, the first man who changed America in your subtitle. And this was John Tyler, the only president, if I have it right, whose death is still not officially acknowledged by the U.S. government because of what he did in his post-presidency. But at the time, in 1840, he was the duly elected vice president of the United States. But there was no certainty that he would become president upon the death of William Henry Harrison, that he might be just acting president. I'm hoping you can talk through that and how John Tyler managed that.
Yes, absolutely. So the framers of the Constitution, they didn't want a vice president in the first place. They ended up adding it as an afterthought, mostly as an electoral mechanism. And they were pretty casual in their language around presidential succession. So Article 2, the succession clause in the Constitution says, and I quote, "In case of the removal of the president from office or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve on the vice president." That language is truly vague, and it's not clear what the framers of the Constitution meant by, quote, "the same" or what they meant by devolve. Mm-hmm. So when John Tyler becomes vice president, he's thrown onto the ticket to win Virginia, which they lost, or to be a nod to states' rights, which didn't really happen anyway. Harrison gives the longest inaugural address in history in 1841, and then Tyler basically skips town for planning to spend 4 years in obscurity. So when Harrison dies after just 30 days in office, Tyler, who's familiar with the language of the Constitution, knows that there's going to be a fight. So he rushes back from Virginia through a combination of horse-drawn carriage, boat, and rail, and he gets ready to fight with the cabinet and fight with Congress over whether or not he's the acting president or the president. And Tyler has a very firm view that he is now the president, not just discharging the duties. And so imagine this, right? The first president has died in office, and the vice president is spending his first, couple days asserting his right to be president. Now, he ends up winning that battle, but at great price to his own presidency.
And he didn't go unchallenged. If I'm right, Jared, didn't even someone as distinguished as John Quincy Adams, a former president himself, said that John Tyler asserting himself as president, not as acting president, just taking on the powers and duties, was in direct violation of the grammar and context of the Constitution.
That's correct. So Henry Wise, who's a congressman from Virginia, proposes an amendment while this debate is happening, trying to sort of suggesting that they formalize that Tyler is the president. And John Quincy Adams, who now is an ex-president and member of Congress, basically goes ballistic. And he asserts that Tyler's assumption of the office of president is a construction in direct violation, both of the grammar and context of the Constitution. And he really lashes out. And then others pile on. So John McKean of New York makes a motion to strike the word president and replace it with vice president, now exercising the office of president. So this goes on for months. Eventually, the Wise Amendment passes, but it's never really bought into. For John Tyler's entire presidency, he's called the great usurper. He's called his accidency. For the rest of his life, he returns letters unopened that are addressed to him as vice president, acting as president, and he ends up really quarreling with the party. So the Whigs end up formally kicking Tyler out of the party after he vetoes a second bank bill. So he ends up not just the first accidental president, he ends up as a president without a party. And like all accidental presidents, he becomes obsessed with the idea of winning the election in his own right. So he realizes that his only path to winning the presidency in 1844 is to throw a wrench in the public discourse. And he decides to make it a wrench over Texas. And he covertly annexes Texas, which precipitates war with Mexico, which does more to accelerate the path to civil war than anything else that had happened to that date. Now, the precedent that Tyler sets in 1841 is very important because even as recently as Lyndon Johnson becomes president in 1963, based on a precedent set by John Tyler in 1841.
I think it's shocking that it was not that long after John Tyler that Zachary Taylor dies and Millard Fillmore ascends to the presidency without any of the controversy that Tyler faced becoming president, just because John Tyler asserted himself in that manner.
That's right. And this is interesting because, and I think in some respects, it's surprising that there's as much controversy and debate around Tyler's assertion that he's president, yet when a second Whig general dies in 1850 and the presidency falls to Millard Fillmore, that there's no debate about this. And there's no debate about it when any other future vice president becomes president. So the Tyler precedent holds very carefully. What's interesting is Tyler is nearly killed in an explosion on board the USS Princeton in 1844. The explosion was an accident while they were firing a state-of-the-art gun called the Peacemaker in tribute to George Washington as they sailed past Mount Vernon. But it killed half the cabinet and more senior officials than any other moment in U.S. history. And it would have killed John Tyler had he not been downstairs below deck flirting with somebody who is more interested in the captain's son. Mm-hmm. But had Tyler been killed in that explosion, there's a real question about whether the precedent he set would have held. But of course, he survives, and it happens seamlessly when Taylor dies. Of course, that transition is not seamless because Millard Fillmore takes the oath of office, and the first thing that he does at the most polarized moment in American history is he sacks the entire cabinet.
Absolutely. We have a case of two accidental presidents, John Tyler and Millard Fillmore, who are not considered among the most successful U.S. presidents. In fact, they're routinely in the bottom 10 to 15 list. But they were followed by a real winner, and that's Andrew Johnson, who became the third accidental president to take office with the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. You write in your book that with Johnson's ascension, what happened was one of the great missed opportunities in American history. Talk through that. What did Andrew Johnson get wrong?
It would be easy to look at how we winged presidential succession and we were so casual about it and say that, you know what, we ended up pretty lucky. Yeah, they were kind of a mixed bag. Some were extraordinary. Others were average. But that would neglect the reality of Andrew Johnson. So Andrew Johnson is thrown onto the ticket in 1864 because Lincoln fully expects to lose that election. And back then, the president didn't choose the running mate, but Lincoln thought the election was important enough that he was involved in a secret intrigue to swap out Hannibal Hamlin for Andrew Johnson because he needed a war Democrat from a border state. And Johnson, as the only Southern senator to stay loyal to the Union, was enormously popular in the North, and he was reviled in the South. And we were supposed to get Abraham Lincoln's vision for Reconstruction. But when the bullet of John Wilkes Booth's gun ends up depriving us of that opportunity, we end up with a man who was born a racist, died a racist, last president to own slaves, didn't emancipate his own slaves until 7 months after the Emancipation Proclamation. We end up with him having a blank piece of paper to design Reconstruction from scratch. And Andrew Johnson has the worst debut of any vice president in history. He's completely inebriated while taking the oath of office. It's supposed to last 30 seconds. It turns into a 17-minute rant against the political aristocracy. He calls out every member of the cabinet. He can't remember the name of the Secretary of the Navy. He then proceeds to slobber all over the Bible, and then he's too drunk to swear in the new senator, so he asks a very young Senate clerk to do it instead of him.
What's shocking about that episode, of course, is that Johnson would do that and start off on such a foot, but to me it also speaks to Abraham Lincoln's forgiveness and compassion, because essentially Andrew Johnson goes on ice for a while, and Lincoln stands up for him and vouches for him and says, nope, he's okay. We can live with this.
Yeah, and I actually think had Lincoln not vouched for him, there was already mounting pressure on Andrew Johnson to resign as vice president. And Lincoln did vouch for him, said, no man has any right to judge Andy Johnson that hasn't been through what he's been through. And Lincoln admired the fact that Johnson had stayed loyal to the Union. He admired the fact that he'd given up essentially a bomb-proof seat in the Senate to take on the military governorship of Tennessee at much risk to his life and his family's life. But Johnson ends up, as president, when the Civil War is over, resurrecting almost every element of the Confederacy. He delegates civil rights to the states. He gives amnesty to the entire Confederate leadership faster than expected. And as a result of Andrew Johnson, you get the Black Codes, which are the precursor to the Jim Crow laws, which come after the election of 1876, ending Reconstruction, and you get the subsequent segregation. Now, the tragedy of all of this is you could have reversed the tide of Andrew Johnson. It was possible. And the one man who could have done it was James Garfield. So in 1880, Garfield wins the Republican nomination without seeking it. The delegates on the 34th ballot decide they don't want Ulysses Grant, they don't want James Blaine, and somebody shouts out Garfield's name. And momentum builds, and he gets the nomination, and he jumps to the front of the convention hall and says, I protest, a man who does not seek the nomination cannot be given the nomination, and they give it to him anyway. So Garfield, completely detached from machine politics and patronage obligations, had as two of his primary goals or political objectives universal suffrage and universal education. And, the Jim Crow laws had only been around for 4 years. If anybody could have put some of it back in a box and reversed the tide of segregation, it was James Garfield. But a mentally ill office seeker named Charles Guiteau put two bullets in him 4 months after taking office.
It's interesting. You've probably looked at it too, but I went back and read the trials of Guiteau, and it was, to think about the modern trials we've had that have become pop culture events, what Guiteau was doing in that courtroom was amazing. And it became a sensation that here was this man who was perhaps delusional, but also said something remarkable when he killed President Garfield. He said he did it to put Chester Arthur into the presidency. Now, we'll talk in a few minutes about Teddy Roosevelt, who you call the most successful accidental president. But Chester Arthur had the best turnaround story. Why did Chester Arthur come in with such a disadvantage, and how did he turn it around?
So Chester Arthur was probably the most loathsome vice president in history. And that's a high bar when you're talking about somebody who is completely inebriated when taking the oath of office. But Chester Arthur was a machine politician to his core, a man so vain that he changed his birthday to appear younger. He spent his entire time as vice president subverting his own administration. He was a stooge of New York party boss Roscoe Conkling, and he cared about one thing and one thing only, which was patronage and the spoil system at the expense of his own president and his own administration. When Garfield is assassinated and Guiteau writes, Arthur is president, shouts, Arthur is president, and I am a stalwart. And it turns out that Guiteau had actually met Arthur a couple times. Arthur more or less has to go into hiding for several months because Garfield lingers on his deathbed for about 80 days. And Arthur is basically hiding because there's angry mobs out for blood because they assume that he's responsible or part of a conspiracy to kill the president. And we know that this impacted Arthur because he tries desperately to get in to see the president. At one point, he insists to the people guarding the president, I must see him to clear my good name. so that the president knows I had nothing to do with his assassination. I mean, imagine, I mean, you have to think about how unbelievable that is, that the vice president of the United States is desperately trying to get in to see the ailing president to convince him that he was not responsible for his assassination. So when Garfield eventually dies, Chester Arthur is overcome with grief. He blames himself for it. It reminds him of not being by his wife's bedside when she died. But he also experiences the wrath of the very first average American to troll the president successfully. A mentally ill woman named Julia Sand, who lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, sent him these very long letters describing him as a despicable man, telling him he was a horrible man, comparing him to the worst characters in the court of King Henry VIII, but always telling him there was still hope for him and his soul could be salvaged. And we know these letters impacted Chester Arthur because one day he got in his presidential carriage and he showed up at her townhouse on the Upper East Side and they spent an hour together. So a man who is the embodiment of the spoil system ends up doing two things that are incredibly important for our country. One, he signs the Pendleton Act, which creates the modern day civil service and begins the process of abolishing the spoil system. But two, he builds up the U.S. Navy, which is in utter disrepair, which had he not done, the U.S. would not have been prepared in the way that it needed to be to win the war against Spain during the McKinley administration.
It's somewhat ironic. Chester Arthur never wanted to be president, and he ended up doing a much better job in the presidency, even winning acclaim from Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, for his job as president, when some of the others who really wanted it, like Millard Fillmore and John Tyler, were clearly not as successful when they were in office.
That's right. And Chester Arthur, out of the eight accidental presidents, is the only one that never sought the presidency in his own right. Now, Millard Fillmore didn't seek election in his own right in 1852, but he eventually ran for a non-consecutive term under what was known as the Know-Nothing Party. But Chester Arthur never sought out the presidency again. In fact, he dies 2 years after leaving office from Wright's disease, which was an umbrella term used to describe various kidney ailments.
Right. By the late 1800s, you point out in the book that one out of three of the last 12 elected presidents had died in office, and yet there was still not a sense that picking the vice president mattered that much. Now, one person did understand the danger, and this was a political boss, Mark Hanna, who had helped get William McKinley into the presidency. And you point out that he tried to sound the alarm bells when there was this man nominated for the vice presidency. He said, "Don't you realize there's only one life between that madman and the presidency?" Who was the madman he was referring to, and how did he become president?
So Teddy Roosevelt was a nuisance to the machine politicians in New York, and they had tired of him as governor, they had tired of him as police commissioner, they had tired of him in the state legislature, and they just wanted him out. And at the time, the only people who became vice presidents were people who were at the tail end of their career and kind of looked the part or were from a particular state or people who needed to be punished. In Teddy Roosevelt's case, the party bosses wanted to exile him to the political equivalent of Elba, and the vice presidency was the perfect place to do that. And Teddy Roosevelt himself, as young as he was conscious of the fact that this could be his political end. And you're right that Mark Hanna, who was a close confidant of William McKinley, was terrified of this. And you know, he's the first one to really talk about a heartbeat away from the president. He tells McKinley, after Teddy Roosevelt gets the nomination as vice president, that your job, Mr. President, is to live for the next 4 years. And of course, McKinley is shot in September of 1901, not long after the election. And Teddy Roosevelt, who his entire life has dreamed of being president, can sort of hardly contain his enthusiasm for the fact that he's about to become president, right? So he asserts himself very quickly, and he has the most amazing quote of any of the accidental presidents, which is, "It's a terrible thing to come into the presidency this way, but it would be far worse to be morbid about it." I think that kind of sums up Teddy Roosevelt, right? Which is, this was a man more ready to be president than any other accidental president in history. And the flaw of all the accidental presidents is that they were utterly ill-prepared.
He was certainly well-prepared by ambition, and he'd had some assignments, Assistant Secretary of the Navy and others, but he wasn't long on experience. And what had basically guided him up to that point was, if you can think it, you can do it. And if you can do it, you do it with all your energy and just plow through everything in your way. That is not necessarily the recipe for a good presidency, and yet you're a fan of his presidency and the things he was able to accomplish. What did he do well that the other accidental presidents did not?
So what I wouldn't describe Teddy Roosevelt as the most successful of the accidental presidents, but he's certainly my favorite. And he certainly had a good presidency, right? You know, he ushered in an era of progressivism that the country might not have been willing to elect otherwise at that stage of the Republic. He broke up the trust. His push for conservation, you know, we're still seeing and experiencing the benefits of today. But what I would say is I think that we should be very lucky that Teddy Roosevelt didn't preside over a war. And we should be thankful that Twitter wasn't around when he was president, because I think he's probably the only president in history that would have given President Trump a run for his money. So I think that Teddy Roosevelt, much to his own dismay, was a victim in terms of his legacy of presiding over peacetime. And, you know, his memory lasts because he was such an outsized personality and such a colorful character. But he didn't preside over one of the seminal moments in the history of our republic.
Right. He also was the first accidental president to get a term of his own when he ran for re-election, as it were. And then he decided to step away because he'd made the promise that he would not seek another term. He regretted it. And his own handpicked successor, William Howard Taft, ended up facing his mentor in 1912. How much did Teddy Roosevelt's comeback, his attempt to win the presidency over his own handpicked successor, how much did that tarnish his legacy?
You know, I don't think it tarnished his legacy, especially since he came back not to run as a Republican. He ran on a new third party, the Bull Moose Party. You know, I think that what Teddy Roosevelt did by challenging William Howard Taft was he handed the presidency to Woodrow Wilson. And Woodrow Wilson was even more of a progressive than Theodore Roosevelt. So I think that you could argue that his legacy as a good Republican was tarnished, but I think the legacy of Theodore Roosevelt lives on. And that was such a dramatic campaign because, of course, he's giving a speech and he gets shot during a campaign stop, and the bullet penetrates a 40-page speech, hits his glasses case, penetrates his skin. He opens up his shirt, examines the wound, declares that he's an expert taxidermist, and that he has about an hour of time before the wound becomes fatal. So he proceeds to give the speech and then goes to the hospital in rather dramatic fashion.
Absolutely. Fast forward just 10 years, and you've got another death in the White House. This time, Warren Harding dies, and it's the first natural cause death in the White House in some 70 years because the previous three dead presidents were assassinated. And that put Calvin Coolidge in the White House. And you point out he's the first to rise to office as an accidental president toward the tail end of his predecessor's term instead of near the beginning of his predecessor's term. Talk through how that mattered and how it played out for Cal Coolidge.
Yeah, this ends up being a really serious problem for Calvin Coolidge because the Harding administration is the most scandal-ridden administration in history. You had the Teapot Dome scandal, which was a massive oil scandal. You had a huge fraud scandal at the Veterans Bureau. And you had an attorney general, Harry Duddery, and a Justice Department who were complicit in everything from fight fixing and gambling and bootlegging to prostitution and stock manipulation, you name it, all the way up to the attorney general and his henchmen. And none of the scandals had broken yet. So Harding dies an incredibly popular man. And Coolidge knows that these scandals are going to break on his watch and it's going to torpedo the election prospects in 1924. So Coolidge does something very clever, which is he basically realizes that his only chance of weathering the storm is to create distance between himself and his scandal-ridden predecessor. So the scandals break about 3 months into Coolidge's presidency, which gets us even closer to the 1924 presidential election. And Coolidge is a pretty self-aware man, and he recognizes that he's a non-entity and not particularly interesting. There's a great story about the Willard Hotel being on fire while Coolidge was vice president, and he's asked to evacuate. And he tells the man ordering him, "But I'm the vice president." And the man says, "Okay, you can stay." And then turns around and says, "Wait, the vice president of what?" And Coolidge says, "The vice president of the United States." And the man says, "Oh, then you need to evacuate. I thought you were the vice president of the hotel." So he really was this non-entity. So what Coolidge does is he doubles down on this status and this reputation, and he cultivates the image of Silent Cal, a man so boring and so insignificant that he couldn't possibly have been complicit in any of these scandals. And while he's doing that, he pioneers broadcast radio in a way never experienced before. And he's anything but silent. He goes right into people's living rooms and, you know, has huge reach into the American Republic. So I think that Coolidge continues the good economic times and continues the policies of Harding, but manages to weather the storm, win election in his own right in 1924, because he effectively creates distance from his predecessor.
Yeah, and it starts a new streak of these accidental presidents who do get elected to their own terms, which was obviously not happening earlier. And now it becomes the new norm, even with the next accidental president. And this was a case where you had the vice president walking to the White House, hearing about the president's death. And he says to the first lady, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And she responds, "No. Is there anything we can do for you? For you are the one in trouble now." Tell us about Harry Truman and the burden and the lack of preparation he had coming into the Oval Office.
So at the 1944 Democratic Convention, all of the Democratic Party bosses know that FDR is a dying man. Nobody talks about it, but the way that they talk about it is by saying they cannot fathom the idea of Henry Wallace, an ultra-liberal who's seen as a Soviet sympathizer, becoming president of the United States. And the party bosses view Henry Wallace much in the same way that Mark Hanna saw Teddy Roosevelt, which is they did not want him anywhere near a heartbeat away from the presidency. So Roosevelt, you know, is an ailing man. He doesn't care who he runs with as long as two things are true. One, he's not seen as having the party bosses impose someone on him. And two, he's not running with somebody who will hinder his chances of winning. And there's basically three men who are acceptable to him: Henry Wallace, Jim Burns, and Harry Truman. He doesn't really care which one he runs with, but he has a slight preference for Wallace. So the party bosses, you know, manipulate the situation such that Truman is thrown on the ticket. It's an incredibly reckless choice that of which is sort of the significance of it is lost in the annals of history, because Truman ended up being remarkable. But in Truman's 82 days as vice president, he doesn't get a single intelligence briefing, doesn't meet a single foreign leader, isn't briefed on the atomic bomb, is unaware of the happenings of the war effort. He's basically out socializing. And this is a man who's a machine politician from Missouri, very provincial, is not particularly worldly, who everybody knows is going to be president, and is doing absolutely nothing to prepare himself. So when FDR dies on April 12, 1945, if you look at what Truman inherits, the Battle of Okinawa is raging in the Pacific. He has to figure out if he's going to have to move a million men from the European theater to the Pacific theater. Stalin is reneging on every single one of his promises from Yalta. There's a bureaucratic turf war that's between the Army and the Navy that's threatening the overall war effort. He has to figure out what to do about this destructive weapon that he's just been briefed on 30 minutes after taking the oath of office. And that's just a handful of what's going on. And yet Truman, in his first 4 months as president, makes more seminal decisions that win the war and shape the post-war order than any president probably in history. And he's this unexpected success. I remember talking to George H.W. Bush, who told me that he didn't think much of Truman, but upon reflection, you know, if you look at what Truman did, he felt like Truman saved his life because he thought he was preparing for a ground invasion of Japan. So Truman is successful because men like Dean Acheson and George Marshall make a conscious decision that the future and the fate of the world rests on Truman's success. And they don't have the luxury of, you know, pushing side agendas and missing the great FDR, and they decide to help make him successful.
There's two potential lessons to take from that. The one that I think we collectively have learned is we need to do a better job of prepping our vice presidents for taking over the presidency. It didn't always work. Kennedy did not always include Lyndon Johnson in the most sensitive meetings. But generally, the story of the past 60 years, 70 years since Harry Truman has been vice presidents are brought into the intelligence and military decisions more than their predecessors used to be. That seems to be the lesson, but there is also another lesson from Truman, which is here's someone who was not prepared, as you mentioned, did not have the intelligence briefings, did not have a strategic conversation with FDR about how he wanted the post-war world to look, and yet he ended up doing pretty well. And maybe it's about having the right people around you more than necessarily having all the right direct preparation. What do you think?
I think it's a mixture of two, right? I think that in order to be a successful accidental president, if you look at the eight, two things have to be true. One, you have to be decisive enough to shake up the parts of the cabinet that aren't invested in your success. And two, you need to have men that you're inheriting who who want your administration to be successful. So if you look at LBJ, LBJ was neither decisive about shaking up parts of the cabinet that he should have gotten rid of, nor did he inherit men that had much of an interest in making him successful. They were all pushing side agendas and manipulating him.
Like Truman, like Coolidge, like TR, LBJ does run for another term and wins it. And then in 1968, he does something odd. He famously takes himself out of the running for re-election on March 31st, announcing that he's going to focus on winning the war in Vietnam. But he was quietly planning behind the scenes to re-enter the race as a hero to answer the party's call at a fractured convention if needed. One senior advisor said that Johnson imagined the delegates botching the convention so badly that he would go in on a flying carpet and be acclaimed as the nominee. But it didn't happen. Johnson refused to signal openly to the delegates he would run, so they didn't take that step, which in turn kept him from saying anything, so the call never came. How different do you think the Vietnam War and the 1970s would have played out if Lyndon Johnson had run in that election and stayed the course?
Well, if Lyndon Johnson had won in that election, he would have died in office. Mm-hmm. So very significant. Right. I mean, this is the part of the story that ends up getting lost, is there's a lot of presidents who died very soon after leaving office. So right. James Polk didn't seek re-election. He dies 3 months after leaving office, which meant he could have died in office. Right. So, you know, I mentioned Chester Arthur dies 2 years after leaving office. So the fact that LBJ had a plan to try to end up as president again in a fractured convention would have meant that shortly after having our eighth accidental president, we would have had our ninth accidental president.
Mm-hmm. And by then, of course, we had the 25th Amendment that had kicked in. So all of the stuff we've talked about the tradition of John Tyler and the fact that presidents became acknowledged universally as the president, that became codified by the 25th Amendment. But that also allowed vice presidents who become president to nominate a new vice president. All up to that point, if a vice president became president and then died, then you go into the succession order, which has varied over time. But the most significant date after the adoption of the 25th Amendment in your story is actually one that doesn't stand out to most Americans. You write about October 28th, 2015, as an important day because of what it signified. What happened then, and why was it unusual in American history?
That date became the longest period of time in American history without a president dying in office, eclipsing the previous chapter of history, which was George Washington to William Henry Harrison's death. So in between, so we're sort of, you know, the period where the president died in office every 10 to 20 years spans a 122-year period that's bookended by the two longest chapters about a president dying. The reason this is significant is if we're in the longest period without a president dying in office, we have the oldest president in the history of the republic. And if you look at recent polling numbers on the Democratic side, the compelling number one and number two are both in their 70s. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, people maybe don't find it that sexy to talk about the vice presidency. I think it's extremely important to talk about it now. I think it's important to talk about it for the incumbent. I think it's important to talk about it for the Democratic race. And we've clearly learned nothing because we're still treating the selection of a vice president as a political gimmick to get a bump in the polls, win a state, appease a constituency. Now, you can do that and still end up with a good choice who's prepared for president. But if you look at how it's set up right now, if you're the presidential nominee, you're incentivized to pick somebody who is sufficiently boring such that they don't upstage you, but not so boring and colorful that they end up embarrassing you. So as I've said before, you're basically looking to appoint or hire the JV version of yourself, which is fine for a campaign, but not fine when you think about the prospects of presidential succession. So at a time when the incumbent is in his 70s, the potential Democratic nominee could be in their 70s, do you really want the JV version of that person a single heartbeat away from the presidency?
So let's talk about how we think about that. How do we change that? Vice presidential candidates, you've said, are chosen often to help a presidential candidate win a swing state or fill a gap in their experience, somehow balance the ticket in one way or another. And yet voters, poll after poll shows, election after election, voters really don't care about the vice president. How can you build some momentum to actually have the voters care enough about the potential president in the person of the vice president that they will look at things like a resume instead of what state they happen to be from, or perhaps whether they're a man or a woman?
So I think you're never going to get the voters to care en masse for the vice presidency, but voters care about the presidency, and you can use that to your advantage in this case. So you could imagine a situation where the party decides that, especially in a race like this where you have 25 people on the Democratic side running, you basically say the only people who will be eligible for vice president are people who've already interviewed for the big job.
Candidates who have run in the party convention so far, people who have run in the primaries.
Exactly. So, and by the way, I would open that up to past and present, right? You know, the it's interesting when Harry Truman was revising presidential succession in 1947, he felt very strongly that the Secretary of State, who was next in line for the presidency, felt very strong that that person needed to be somebody who in the past had been elected, past or present, had been elected to national office. So if you follow that same logic, somebody who's auditioned for the job already in the past or in the present has had an opportunity to show the American people how they would perform as president of the United States, such that the American people have been able to have an opinion about it.
The logic being, even if they had not been elected president, at least they'd been elected to something, so they'd had some public vetting of their character and their background.
That's correct. And so then what you could imagine is taking the sort of superdelegate concept and having, you know, some number of delegates who represent a microcosm of the party look at that requirement of people who have run for president, past or present, and serving as a committee to decide, you know, who should be the vice presidential nominee for president, and then putting that before the convention for the delegates to vote.
Yeah, let's play out a scenario here to close. Let's say that we finish recording this podcast and we open up our Twitter machines and we see that the vice president is president because the president has resigned, or that some other situation has evolved such that we have a new accidental president in the person of Mike Pence. How do you think that would play out in the immediate term in terms of the acceptance of the president and how the public would react, given that it has been a historically long time since we have seen this actually happen?
So I think if it were to happen today, it would be hard to find a precedent for it, just because of the, you know, even though Taylor died in a highly polarized moment, he wasn't really a political figure. I mean, he didn't even vote in his own election. So I think that the reaction to the the reaction historically to the president dying in office has not been a polarized reaction. I think you would find a much more polarized and politicized mourning period. And it would be a really complicated set of emotions that I think would exacerbate tensions in this country, because I think you would have, you know, people inappropriately not mourning the president and people mourning the president and everything in between. Now, my view on Mike Pence is he was a governor of a major state, and you can like or not like his policies, but the man is integrated into the administration. He knows what's going on. He knows how to be an executive, and he's perfectly capable of being president. I think the challenge in his case is, you know, he probably would have to take a page from the Calvin Coolidge book and figure out how much he wants to distance himself from his predecessor.
In terms of preparation, you can't deny that vice presidents are generally better prepared now than they were at the start of your story back in the 1800s. I mean, let's think about it. Mike Pence, every vice president since Hubert Humphrey, has received the president's daily brief and been briefed on top secret intelligence. They are often, usually involved in meetings of the National Security Council and all other major decisions. So is it fair to say that a lot of the stories about accidental presidents that you write about, some of those hurdles would be less for any new accidental president, even if there are new ones, such as the polarization you're talking about?
I would say that that is the trend that we're seeing, but it's not protected by law. So if you look as recently as 2008, if John McCain and Sarah Palin had won, it is really hard for me to imagine that Sarah Palin would have been well integrated into the national security apparatus. So you look at, you know, how old John McCain was at the time and how incompetent Sarah Palin was, you know, as a political mind and national security figure. And that would have really tested the norms that, as you correctly said, have existed since Hubert Humphrey. I've advocated that, you know, we want to avoid a Harry Truman type situation. So, you know, to me, you know, appropriate bipartisan legislation would say that the vice president is empowered by law to create a national security apparatus and to request intelligence briefings. The reason Truman didn't do it, you know, it wasn't that he was being totally negligent, but, you know, at a time when you had the great FDR as president, you couldn't be seen as anticipating his death, especially when the president himself didn't acknowledge it.
Right. Well, it's interesting with the Sarah Palin case you mentioned. Here's somebody who, by your measure, has been vetted by the people. She was elected governor of Alaska, so she checks that box. But you put her up against, let's say, a Colin Powell, who was not elected to anything. But most people, when thinking about who they would want making those decisions in the White House, would say, well, we have greater trust in General Powell than we do in Governor Palin. So there's something beyond just the getting elected and being vetted to something that matters when it comes to an accidental president rising into the Oval Office.
Well, as Dick Cheney said to me, the only thing that matters with a vice president is, are they able to lead should the unthinkable happen on day one? And there's two aspects of that. There's one, their ability. And then two, you know, are they sufficiently in the loop to be able to pick up the mantle on day one? It's crazy to me that Harry Truman had to spend his first 3 days in the map room, literally figuring out where countries were and literally, you know, getting up to speed on a war that had been raging for multiple years. So, you know, my suggestion that somebody has to have run for the highest office in the land to be eligible doesn't absolve the parties of responsibility to still choose somebody who, if you follow Cheney's narrative, could be ready to lead on day one.
Yeah. One final question for you. In the unlikely scenario that there were a president and a vice president who were disabled or otherwise not performing the duties of the office, then it bounces to someone from Capitol Hill. And you have someone who has not been in on the top-level intelligence briefings at the same level, who has not been in the National Security Council, who may be unaware of any of the executive's policies, similar to what Truman inherited from FDR, even though he was in the executive branch, but someone from the legislative branch coming over and suddenly becoming president. That's a shock to the system we have not experienced yet. How do you think we would manage that?
Yeah, that's a great point, right? And I think it's even more complicated when the Speaker of the House is of a different political party, like right. The current situation that we're in right now. You know, the good news is I do think members of Congress, just in their day-to-day affairs, are getting intelligence briefings and are up to speed. But there is room for we've revised presidential succession laws going all the way back to 1792. So in 1792, the presidential succession law, you know, says that, you know, if there's a vacancy in the president and the vice president, then the president pro tem becomes an acting president until the Secretary of State can schedule a special election, and then it's followed by the Speaker of the House. Then in 1886, they get rid of the president pro tem and the Speaker, and if there's a double vacancy, then the Secretary of State and then the rest of the cabinet becomes an acting president until a special election. And then it's revised again in 1947, where they reinstate the Speaker of the House and the president pro tem in that order.
Right.
And then you have the 25th Amendment in 1967. So, you know, we should be constantly revising these laws. And I think if you look at everything from the designated survivor and so forth, we try to account for all these different things. But I think the gap that you raise is an important one, which is, how do you ensure that the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem, who are the only two non-members of the administration to be in the line of succession, how do you make sure that they're sufficiently in the loop, particularly in a hyper-partisan time when they're of a different political party?
Plenty of challenges to address, and we're better off when we address them with some knowledge of the history. Thanks for bringing this history alive with your book, Accidental Presidents. Jared Cohn, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jared Cohn for coming on the show. Please do share the podcast, rate it, tweet about it. Any way to publicize it certainly helps. This episode is edited and produced by the tireless Jen Patya Howell. Michaela Fogel stepped up as audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.